Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King starts things off and answers this question. Is the year of governing over? Then today's Globe features a Harvard study saying the more you experience different kinds of people, the more accepting you are. Well, that's a revelation. Nevertheless, we're going to ask you, do you experience other kinds of people, or do you just hang out with others like you? Then, yet another of the people who want to be the next governor of Massachusetts, Treasurer Steve Grossman, joins us in studio.
The Boston Globe's Shira Springer, just back from the Sochi Olympics, will detail the thrills of victory, the agonies of defeat, and how Russians dress their salads. Then historian Nancy Kane from the Harvard Business School on the minimum wage fight. Is it good for American business or not? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 Boston Public Radio, WGBH.
And by the way, if people are listening to Boston Public Radio and have listened every day since we started, how long would they have been listening?
Well, I do know that.
What's that, Marjorie?
Today is our year anniversary.
Yes,
Jim.
It is. Happy anniversary,
Thank
Marjorie.
Thank you very much, Jim.
And to our colleagues on the BPR team and all of you as well. So in 2014 is the year of governing over. And might next year's Super Bowl in Arizona be over as well? Joining us to take on these and other national headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent. He's also host of the Sunday morning show on CNN, Inside Politics. Hey, John King.
I feel like since I didn't send cigars or a cake, I should sing. Except I can't sing.
Well, that's
it's
a problem.
Okay. We accept
Thank you
your
very
congratulations.
Much. And thanks for being a part of this, John. You're a huge part of
very
it.
Very much. You know, John, sometimes I think
it's been great.
Great.
We do, too. Believe me, we are beyond thrilled, let me tell you. But, you know, sometimes I think we live in sort of this weird outpost of the United States here in Massachusetts. You know, I really couldn't believe it when I found out that the legislature in Arizona last week passed a bill that would allow people that are very religious to deny service to gay people in businesses or even individuals can do it. Now, of course, it's before Governor Jan Brewer to sign. What's going to happen here, John?
Look, we have to wait for Governor Brewer here. She's facing a lot of pressure from social conservatives to sign it, but even more pressure from the business community. Even some people who were for this legislation in theory at the beginning now are starting to hear about these boycott threats and some of the backlash against them. She has until Friday. I talked to one of her top people yesterday who wouldn't tell me what she is going to do, but the indication was that she would act before Friday. Sometimes that changes when people come under competing pressures. She signed, remember, that controversial immigration law.
Yes.
So here is Jan Brewer once again at a social and political crossroads for the country. I will say this. We can focus on the specifics of this law, and it's worth focusing on because it is so controversial. But just think for a second how fast the gay rights / same-sex marriage debate in our country has moved. George W. Bush beat John Kerry in a very close election, in part because in Ohio and several other key states, they had those constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. And Bush closed every campaign speech in the final stretch with that theme. It was 2004. That's not that long ago when you think about the arc of history. Now you have Eric Holder saying he's going to help states, you know, get rid of their bans on same-sex marriage. And the president of the United States went from an opponent to a proponent. But now Arizona is front and center again. Our politics on this question are changing, and changing dramatically. And even a lot of Republicans who you would put in the social conservative camp are starting to rethink, you know, legislation like this. They may have their personal views. Their views may not change. But should the government be doing this? This is a fast-evolving debate, and Arizona is going to give us another example.
A couple of things about pressure on her. One, the two United States senators, I believe Flake and McCain, not exactly left-wingers, have both urged her to veto. I assume that matters. But is it possible that the NFL decides to move the Super Bowl if it turns out that, which is scheduled for Arizona next year, if she decides to sign this thing?
I think that is a very serious threat. You know, the NFL has not said so explicitly or publicly, and you can bet Jan Brewer's staff is trying to, you know, scope that one out from an intelligence standpoint. But think of what's happening in the NFL. They're about to, you know, welcome their first openly gay player, Michael Sam, when he's drafted. So then you're going to go into Arizona. You know, our sports leagues, Adam Silver, the new commissioner of the NBA, I think put this really well the other day. He's a friend of mine, so I'm biased. But when Jason Collins was signed by the Brooklyn Nets, and, you know, they called him for kind of an attaboy, shouldn't the NBA be proud? He said sports has actually been behind the curve when it comes to these issues. But the sporting community is, you know, it's on the curve now, and it has a chance maybe to make up for past slowness or to, you know, acknowledge past slowness. And I do think that, you know, as we see this breakthrough in the NBA and now a coming breakthrough in the NFL, you know, the commissioner would face a lot of pressure if Arizona passed this law, if she signed it into law.
We're talking with John King from CNN. You know, John, you may not know this, and so I hate to put you on the spot, but I certainly don't know. I mean, all I know about Arizona is the weather's great and it's really hot out there and everybody loves to go there in the wintertime from Massachusetts. But is this whole push to deny the service to gays and lesbians, is this evangelical Christians or is this Catholics? I mean, who are these people? Do you have any idea?
It's a mix. It's a mix. You have a, you know, is it a majority of Arizonans? I think not. Is it a strong group in the legislature that thinks, you know, that has, what's the right way to put it, that thinks that what's happening in the country, that they are opposed to it for religious and moral reasons, and they think somebody, you know, should be able to say no? But again, you write this sweeping legislation. You know, can a photographer turn down a same-sex couple to shoot, you know, if they try to hire him to shoot their wedding? That's an interesting conversation. Is there an individual choice there? Or if you have a business and you have public insurance and public facilities, are you somehow bound to do it? It's a legitimate conversation. I don't want to discount the individual rights of any one person in America to have their own beliefs. That's what the First Amendment is for. And so just as you can be a strong proponent of gay rights, you have every right to be a strong, you know, opponent. That's our country. That's the gift of our country. When you get into writing laws about what you can and cannot do, that's when it gets dicey. And a lot of even gay rights opponents, and that's overgeneralizing using that term, but even people who don't like same-sex marriage and who think it's wrong think this law is too sweeping.
You know, one of the finest moments in the debate about this, I don't know if you saw Anderson Cooper last night, who did an interview with a state senator, Republican state senator from Arizona, who was one of the champions of this bill, who also is running for the Republican nomination for governor there. And Cooper asked him repeatedly, can you give me one example of someone who had to violate their deep-held religious beliefs in Arizona, who had to serve somebody who was gay or whatever else they objected to because of their religious beliefs? And ultimately, when he asked him four or five times, you know what the end of the sentence is, the answer was no. And he tried to escape by saying, but you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. So it's a solution in search of a problem, which leads me to believe, based on nothing except her business sense, that Brewer ends up deciding this is not a good thing for Arizona, and hopefully she vetoes this. Hey, John, speaking of Brewer, she was on her way home from the National Governors Association meeting in Washington. The president joked that a lot of the governors were measuring the drapes as they were there. How many of the people who were assembled in Washington at the White House are thinking of running for the presidency?
Well, I always joke that every governor thinks he or she should be president and could be president. Jen Brewer's not a spring chicken, and I don't say that to insult her. One of the factors I do think, Jim and Marjorie, in this is when she signed SB 1070, the immigration law, she was up for re-election. She's term limited now, so she does not face pressure from her conservative base. She's not worried about a primary challenge, and I think should she veto this law, that would be, you know, part of the politics there is that she has freedom, if you will. Now, to the governors, even Deval Patrick, how many times have we said he's not running for president? And now I saw that he says, well, maybe down the road somewhere. So they're all measuring the drapes, right? you know, Governor Kasich of Ohio didn't come. Governor Cuomo of New York didn't come. Maybe they have friends who already got them the measurements. Look, Bobby Jindal's thinking hard about running. Chris Christie's thinking hard about running. Rick Perry's sort of quasi-running. There are several other Republicans, Mike Pence of Indiana. I mentioned Governor Kasich. Perhaps one or two more, Scott Walker of Wisconsin. Some of them, Walker and Kasich, chief among them, have to win re-election first this year. But there are a half dozen sitting Republican governors who are thinking about it. There's the big former Republican governor, Jeb Bush, who's thinking about it. You've got three Democratic governors, O'Malley of Maryland, Cuomo of New York, Hickenlooper of Colorado, looking at it, but they're looking first to this lady named Hillary Clinton. I don't know if you've heard of her, to see what she wants to do. So there are a lot of, when it comes to 2016, there are at least 10 governors looking at it. And then you look beyond 2016, you have a younger class of governors coming up who, I actually think, I started covering national politics, you know, back in the Dukakis days. when you had, you know, Dukakis in Massachusetts, you had Mario Cuomo in New York, you had Jim Thompson in Illinois, and then Tommy Thompson and John Engler came along, and Bill Clinton in Arkansas, Jim Hunt in North Carolina. You had this great group of governors, Democrats and Republicans, who were policy guys. You could disagree with them, but it was a great time to talk to people about policy. And I think it's great. I think we can all learn from governors of all stripes politically. And so in my view, the more the merrier in both parties, because you get a better debate.
You know, in a second, we want to catch up on what you just mentioned about Jeb Bush. One of the things you talked about, I know, on Sunday is this is take a Bush to beat a Clinton. But our weekly feature with John King, where in the world is Chris Christie? Why was Christie, he's chair of the Republican Governors Association, why was he not at the White House?
He said he wanted to be home for his daughter's 18th birthday. I have a 17-year-old daughter.
Okay.
I know how important that can be, number one. Number two, he's presenting his budget this afternoon. So he does have important state business. But let's also be honest. You know, he's dealing with the Bridgegate investigation. And he thinks, and I think smartly so, well, he is doing a lot of fundraising for the National Republican Governors Group. I think in terms of his profile, he wants to prove to people that, you know, he can get his work done in New Jersey, that these investigations are not disabling his day job.
We're talking with John King from CNN, and you did mention in your Sunday morning show, 8:30 on CNN, the whole question of whether or not it takes a Bush to beat a Clinton. Jeb Bush, of course, the former Republican governor. You just mentioned him in Florida, the former Florida governor. You just mentioned him as a possibility. So Republicans are talking about this. What's the calculation?
Number one, that he's a big swing state popular Republican. That if you're looking at the map of what's happened in the last couple presidential elections, you're a Republican, you're scratching your head about Ohio and Florida, and you're thinking, if we can't figure those out, we probably can't win, no matter who we're running against. Number two, he's more of an establishment mainstream Republican, and there are a lot of fundraisers and strategists type two. And again, this is early, boys and girls, which is February 2014, I guess almost March 2014. But they're thinking Christie's, you know, wounded a little bit, and we don't want Ted Cruz, who's our guy. And Jeb's been thinking about it himself, and he did I was really fascinated yesterday. Find it online if you haven't seen it. He did this town hall after a speech in Long Island yesterday, you know, not a hot box of presidential politics in the United States. But the guy's been off the bike for a long time. He hasn't run for office in a decade, really. And a lot of people were wondering, does he still have it? And he did this fascinating town hall. Again, I'm not agreeing with anything he said, but watch it when he's answering questions about education, about health care, about politics, about tolerance, about just, you know, talking to each other in a more civil way. He's an interesting guy. He's. I think that adding a Jeb Bush caliber person to the Republican debate would be good for the party as it tries to find its way.
Yeah, but let's ask the obvious question, is how many Bushes are too many Bushes? There's obviously the father, who I think many people, even people who didn't vote for him, feel pretty decent about. There's the younger Bush, obviously, George W., who people have, I'd say, I think being charitable, at least mixed feelings now. How much baggage does a Jeb Bush bring to a race?
He joked about that, and he said, of course, it's a factor. He mentioned being on an airplane once with an Obama supporter, and he asked the Obama supporter, why are you for Obama? And he said, well, we had a Clinton, and then we had a Bush, and then we had a Bush, then a Clinton, and then we're going to have another Bush, and then another Clinton. And he says, so I'm for the new guy. And he laughed about that.
The new guy.
And then he said, so he'd be held to that. That would be a problem for him, an issue for him, a hurdle for him. But then he laughed and said it would be for Hillary, too. So maybe it's less of a factor if you have it in both parties, not just one.
So, John King, one of the other things you talked about on your Sunday morning show, which was, as you point out, kind of depressing, but true, this idea of the year governing being over, that even though we're 254 days away from the election, that both parties are so worried about getting reelection that nothing is going to happen. And that John Boehner has already kind of retreated on immigration reform, and we don't know what's going to happen with the minimum wage thing. So it is really depressing. Is there no hope for anything in the next 254 days?
It's not much. It's 252 now until the
252,
election.
252, excuse
morning.
Me. You're right.
But I'm the one idiot in America counting. The rest of you don't have to. It's my public service. I'm doing it for you.
Thank you.
I made the point because, you know, the speaker pulls back on immigration, something he really in his heart wants to do. Then the president drops his Social Security reform from his budget. He put it in there last year, saying, you know, I want to reach out to Republicans, entitlement reform and deficit reduction are important. And then he pulls it. And he pulls it for one reason. Just like Speaker Boehner doesn't want to have a fight with the conservative base, the president doesn't want to have a fight with his liberal base. It's smart politics, I guess. But if you're thinking about, you know, these guys got elected to govern, right? Did they just get elected to run? It's become the permanent campaign, and it's not. It's now it's chess. You know, Boehner plays to the base, Obama plays to the base. A lot of people listening don't like this proposed reform. You know, the president accepted last year, so they think it's a good thing. A lot of people out there probably do want those immigration reforms, but that's a bad thing. My point is that they're not even having conversations about compromise and governing. They're just looking at November and saying, what do we do to, you know, maximize our base turnout and minimize any internal strife that could hurt turnout?
See, this is why some people like me, John King from CNN, think we need term limits. I mean, you just mentioned Jan Brewer not running for re-election. She's term limited. She doesn't have to worry about pleasing certain extreme constituencies within Arizona. This, to me, is yet another argument for term limits. We got 252 days left, but we can't do anything if everybody's too worried about being re-elected.
And the longest-serving member of the House, John Dingell, is going to retire. And his lobbyist wife is going to run for his seat because she has such a fundraising advantage, she might win. I don't know that term limits is the answer. Remember, that was part of the Republican contract back in 1994. You had some members who won who had said as part of that contract they would only serve, you know, I think it was 3 terms, 6 years in the House. And some of them left, and then some of them decided no. I could make a strong argument to the point you're making, Marjorie, that we just need fresh faces and term limits are great. I could make a really strong argument that when we're dealing with issues like the Pentagon budget, which is a big proposal right now, when you're dealing with these issues like Social Security reform and education reform, don't you want a mix of, yes, some fresh faces, but also some people who've been at it? You know, should we have term limited Ted Kennedy, or was his expertise important not only to the people of Massachusetts and not only to liberals, but to conservatives when they cut the deal on, you know, Medicare prescription drugs, or when they cut the deal on No Child Left Behind, because he knew how to negotiate with the other side and cut deals. So you can argue it either way. In this climate, when nothing gets done, look, there's the only one thing the two parties agree on, and that's doing everything possible to not allow an infrastructure for a third party. If you had a viable independent movement in this country right now, a lot of incumbents would lose elections.
You know, so I must assume, based on your comments, that all of the crowing about by the Democrats about how we have the advantage on the minimum wage fight, even though the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says that 500,000 jobs are going to be lost, that all this crowing is purely about midterm elections. It's not because they think they have a chance in hell of getting anything through this Congress. Is that correct?
Again, it's very hard. You have philosophical Republican opposition, not universal, but leadership to raising the minimum wage. You have a number of state-based efforts happening, and even some Republicans are saying that's the way it should be done. Different states should decide what works for them. And then you have some conservative Democrats who either don't want to raise the minimum wage anyway because they think it's bad, they just philosophically think it's wrong, or they just think I can't cast that vote this year. And so if you look at national polling, I always say this in presidential years, and I'm going to say it even more in this midterm year. In national polling, raising the minimum wage is like a 70% issue. So the president is on safe ground. He's on high ground. He's on popular ground. Even a lot of, you know, downscale white Republicans out in rural America think we should raise the minimum wage. However, when you look at where the 50 most competitive House races are and where those 11 or 12 most competitive Senate races are, it's less popular ground. In some cases, it's unpopular ground, and in many places, it's just less popular ground. So when you look at a national poll, remember, that's not what we're talking about this year. We're talking about, you know, 10 or 11, maybe 12 Senate races. They tend to be in places the president lost, more conservative areas of the country.
We're talking with John King from CNN. I almost hesitate to mention this since nothing's going to happen anyway, but the Defense Secretary, Chuck Hagel, has proposed doing a lot of things about the Pentagon budget that you just mentioned, making the military much, much smaller, closing bases, and then doing things that I think would be hard to get through, assuming anything can get through anymore, smaller pay raises for the veterans, slowing down the growth of tax-free housing allowances, things like that, paying more to their health insurance. I presume that Chuck Hagel is just saying these things and nothing's going to happen with this either.
Something will happen with this, actually. This is a fascinating debate. Talking to you guys on Tuesday helps me prepare for, you know, my show on Sunday because we have these extended conversations. Think about this. Think about when Michael Dukakis was running for president, right, and he got in the tank. That was, you know, it was a silly photo op, but it was used as a metaphor for, you know, liberal Democrats are soft on defense. They want to slash defense spending. Liberal Democrats on social issues, you know, either they're pro-abortion or they're pro-gay rights. Think of the debates we're having now, slashing the Pentagon budget substantially. And yes, Dick Cheney says it's a bad idea, and Marco Rubio says it's a bad idea, but Rand Paul doesn't think it's such a bad idea. There's a libertarian streak in the Republican Party or a deficit reduction streak in the Republican Party that says we have to cut some because we have to find some money to save or we have to change our role in the world. Look at the difference on the crime debate. Rand Paul working with Eric Holder on restoring the voting rights of felons. I mean, that, you know, that would have been a soft on crime ad in the late 1980s, right?
Yeah.
What about the gay rights debates? I mean, it's, the old rules in politics don't necessarily apply. It doesn't mean that the Dick Cheneys don't pull up that same playbook every time when it comes to defense cuts. And he has a principal position. I'm not saying his position is all politics. He believes what he believes, and, you know, that's fine. But you can now, you can put this kind of a defense budget forward. And we have to have this policy discussion. We have to have it. Is it right to shrink the Army that much? I don't know. It's above my pay grade. But do we have to deal with cyber war? Do we have to deal with Asia, which is more of a naval challenge? Do we have to deal with the benefits for all these kids who are coming home with injuries and PTSD and pensions? Yes, we do. And so we have to have this conversation. I hope it's not dismissed in knee-jerk politics.
Well, John King, one of the things I don't understand the opposition to, and actually you mentioned bipartisan support and so forth and doing unusual things. Rand Paul teamed up with Barney Frank, one of the most liberal Democrats in Congress, to say we need to shut down some of these bases that we have in places that could well afford their own bases, some of these European countries, like Germany, for example. So what is the argument against that? I don't see why we would want to keep paying all that money to have our let the Germans defend themselves. I mean,
let the U.S. representative to the, you know, NATO mission in someplace in Italy have a house or a condo, not a mansion. You should see some of these places.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, but it's built-in infrastructure, and they don't want to give it up. It's my little fiefdom, and so everybody protects their fiefdom. But you make a good point. These unlikely partnerships, and Rand Paul's involved in, we mention him a lot, and people think we're taking sides. He's involved in a lot of them because he thinks outside the box on some of these questions. But, you know, one of the things Chuck Hagel wants to do is phase out the A-10. I remember, I'm old, covering the first Persian Gulf War, watching the A-10s over Saudi Arabia and Kuwait into southern Iraq when all that was playing out back in the Saddam Hussein days and the George H.W. Bush days. Even then, you know, there was a debate about, do we still need this old beast? Now, it's effective. It flies low. It kills tanks. Are we going to have a tank war with Vladimir Putin, you know, across Central Europe? We didn't use them as much in, you know, even in Afghanistan. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda didn't have tanks. Saddam Hussein did to a degree way back in the day. But where are those A-10s built? Where are those jobs? Where do they build the engines for the A-10s? Where do they build those, you know, the heavy steel super bullets for those tanks? That is the question that comes up in politics, just like closing bases. Where's the factory? Where's the jobs? And, well, Congress micromanages the Defense Department in ways that are pork barrel politics.
You know, it's amazing to me, last thing for me, John, that you were able to keep up on all this stuff, because obviously you're focused on the burning question. I know that everybody is. Who should lead off for the Red Sox now that their leadoff hitter is playing for the Yankees? Who would you put in the number one spot, John?
Well, if Daniel Nava can do it, I think I'm as fast as him, so maybe I can do it. it's an interesting question. Obviously, they think that Jackie Bradley's not ready for that. I think they see him as maybe 4 or 5 years down the road if he develops being in that spot. Shane Victorino, I think, is the most logical guy who can put his bat on the ball, who's got good speed. But I was reading in the Globe yesterday, the hitting coach talking about how smart Nava is, and he doesn't have the speed of an Ellsbury, but he's a good situational hitter. So I think they're going to experiment a little bit. And I think, look, I understand the price tag, but I think they're going to miss Ellsbury, and I think they're going to have to figure it out.
Listen to the smile in John King's voice whenever we touch on the season that's just a month away. When's the first game? Do you know what it is, BC and Northeastern?
Isn't it Northeastern tomorrow? It's this week.
I think it is this week, and let the games begin. Hey, John, it's great to talk to you as always. John King, thanks so much for your time.
I'm available, Larry.
John King is CNN's chief national correspondent and host of the Sunday morning show Inside Politics. You can see it every Sunday at 8:30 here in Boston. It's always great to talk to John King. And up next, we're going to look at a new Harvard study about T platforms and demographics. How we respond to the strangers around us. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
This afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered, we take a deeper look at the problem of homelessness, focusing on one family that made the transition from a shelter to a home of their own.
Here, I have my own room. I could put posters in it, have friends over more, and so I like it here.
I'm reporter Adam Riley. Why permanent housing is the best solution to homelessness, and why getting it isn't easy. That's this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Grogan & Company Fine Art Auctioneers, assisting New England families with the sale of their fine art, antiques, silver, and jewelry since 1988, located in historic Dedham, Massachusetts, and at groganco.com. And Northeastern University, where researchers are untangling the complexities of climate change to measure the true cost to the world's cities. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A new Harvard study on commuter rail platforms found that when you expose train riders to people of different ethnic backgrounds, riders first recoil a bit. Then, gradually, they become more accepting as days pass. Now, it's so obvious to me, it's ridiculous. Maybe because the more exposure you have to anything, the more accepting you are of it. But that's not where we want to go with you. We want to know at 877-301-8970, is it time for you to get, at least on the figurative, commuter rail? Do you surround yourself with people who are just like you in all kinds of ways? Race, class, those sort of things. There was a study, the census, that was done in 2010. Boston is the 11th most extreme residentially segregated city between black and whites in the United States. Is that great book? Remember that book years and years ago? I love the title. Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And the question we want, I don't want to discuss this Harvard study because I cannot believe that anybody paid for this. It is so obvious. It is pathetic. But it does, what you get, you think of when you read the story in the Boston Globe is that we don't, a lot of us don't have contact with people who are not the same as we are. And we want to know what your lives are like, both at home, in your communities, at your workplace. Is it racially mixed? Is it mixed in terms of class? Do you go out to lunch with people who are not like you? Do you spend time on the weekends with people who are not like you? Or essentially, do we retreat like those kids at the cafeteria and sit together literally and figuratively? Our number is 877-301-8970. Was I unfair to this Harvard? It is. You know, it's sort of like, you know, the study we've talked about for years, all the polls show that people who know, say they know a gay person,
right,
support gay marriage.
Yeah.
And if they don't, they, at least in larger numbers, they don't. Obviously, whenever you have exposure to anybody and anything, your acceptance of that anybody and anything grows immediately.
Well,
so I'm not sure we needed this particular study.
Well, that's why the argument for diversity in the workplace, to have different perspectives on the world from, you know, whether you're black, white, women, Asian, the whole, you know, nine yards. But I think it's hard for lots of people because you think about it, in your workplace, you may be in a professional workplace where everybody there, you know, went to college for some part of their life or they had a certain academic achievement. And think about how many really economically mixed neighborhoods there are. Okay, Dorchester is a very economically mixed neighborhood where you have some people that have done quite well and some people that are just barely getting
by. Well, it depends what part of Dorchester, too.
Yeah, but, well, either a couple blocks in the direction. I mean, I think Dorchester is a pretty mixed neighborhood.
I agree with that.
Or Mattapan to a lesser degree, or maybe Hyde Park or something. When you think about outside of Boston, well, you go to a place like Lynn. Lynn is a struggling town. I mean, I suppose there are some wealthy people in Lynn, but most of us, the point I'm trying to make here is most of us live surrounded by neighbors that are in the same economic class because you wouldn't be able to afford a house in Wellesley unless you were making a lot of money.
Yeah, but I think even people live in more racially diverse.
You're a diverse city over there in Cambridge.
It is pretty diverse. I mean, despite all the stereotyping, it's a pretty diverse city.
Well, as long as you keep out of Harvard Square.
Nobody lives in Harvard Square. But despite all, even places that are diverse in terms of residences and workplaces, isn't the sense you get that people, I don't think it's a function of classism or racism. Don't you think, for the most part, people, even if it's subconsciously, seek out people who are like them and are magnets to people who are like them. Don't you think that's true, even in environments that are diverse?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. Christopher's emailing from New Hampshire. He says he lives in a very diverse city and encounters at work a lot of diverse people there. So he's doing the opposite of what I think is typical for most people. But there you go.
No, that's not has no relevance to this conversation, Christopher. With all due respect, we all encounter diversity everywhere we go. The question is, do we integrate it into our lives? 877-301-8970 is our phone number. And if you want to comment on this Harvard study, I don't mean to disparage this person who did the study, but it's one of these things where how do I get a job like that? How do I get to do a study and get funded to demonstrate the obvious? Our numbers are 877-301-8970. What?
I just have a funny email from Steve.
What's that?
Who says, during my commute and at the office, I surround myself with people who are just like me, miserable.
Well, that's exactly. You know, there's some great comments on the study. And again, I don't mean to obsess on this. I swore I wasn't going to talk about it for more than a second. I wanted to get on, but I will. If the study's results are true, that's all well and good. But what do you do with the information? Force immigrants to move to the suburbs? Because essentially they hired some, I believe it was Mexicans in this thing, right? To ride the commuter rail to stand on the platform. And this other commenter on the Globe story says an advanced study of the obvious. Let's go to Worcester, where Chuck is first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Chuck.
Jim and Marjorie, thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure.
I've traveled over in Worcester here quite a bit, and as you all know, you use the train over there quite often for transportation.
Hey, Chuck, we're going to put you on hold for 1 second. The connection is horrible. We'll take another call, and we'll get right back to you. My apologies. Don't go away.
Jack from Haverhill. Hi, Jack.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
Great. Great conversation we're going to have here because it's one of my favorites.
Take it away.
I rode the Long Island Railroad for about close to 20 years into Manhattan.
Yep.
There was a large diversity of people there, and I integrated very well with them. And at my job, we've got Spanish, white, black, Chinese, and it's awesome. And I think the commonality, I think if everyone kind of steps back for a second, look at the notion that we're all connected. We're all children of the Lord. We all should respect one another and have that peace about you because it's contagious. Because once people sense that about you, then they get relaxed and so I never really had a problem with it. I think it's a really good thing to have.
Yeah, but let me ask Jack. You're the perfect person to talk to. So you're in a closed environment on the LIRR. I think you said the Long Island Railroad.
That's correct.
You're exposed to people not like you, and people who aren't like you are exposed to you. And then you go to work the same thing. Do you take those examples into the rest of your life where you have more control? You have no control over who's in the subway or who's in your workplace. How much of that extends to what you do on the weekends, who you go to dinner with, who you hang out with? How much of that?
Oh, tremendously. Tremendously.
Oh, that's
great.
Because
my church body, for example, I absolutely adore because we don't just put a key in our backs on Sunday and go to church. We actually integrate and we do all kinds of ministries and stuff during the week and on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And we go and we have dinner with each other. I mean, it's fantastic. I love it. I think the world needs to get to. That's my dream, and I'm on my soapbox now. But that's my dream. Everyone kind of just drop. If anyone has discomfort or prejudices or what have, put it by the wayside.
Ride the ride commuter rail, ride the LIRR. Jack, thanks for a great call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970 is our number.
Jack sounded so together, didn't he?
He did. I mean, but I think, and again, this is my cup half empty kind of thing, I think he's the aberration. Most of us do work in diverse places. Again, I'm not just talking about race. I am talking about I'm talking about all kinds of things, different experiences. But I think you tend to gravitate. I think subconsciously, in most cases, you tend to gravitate to people who are like you in all kinds of demographic ways.
Well,
Jack is an aberration.
It's also, like I said, the people that you meet. I mean, if you live in a diverse neighborhood, your kids go to a diverse school, you're going to get friendly with people that are different than you are. If you don't, then it's really hard.
Well, except let's go back to the book whose title we both love, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? The point of that book was that it isn't an all-black school. The point is there were black kids, there were white kids, there were Latino kids. The black kids were sitting with each other. The white kids were sitting with each other. And this is, by the way, this book is written 20 years ago.
But I also
saying it's still true. I'm just saying the point there, I think, still has some relevance.
But, well, I also thought one of the things that was bad about that book is that high school kids are so wrapped up in who they are and what their identity is.
Yeah.
And you know, am I a black kid from Boston and MECO program? Am I a black kid from Brookline that lives in Brookline? It's all about identity. So I'm not sure that
Well, that's exactly the point I'm making. I'm not saying it's all based on race at all.
But I think people feel differently as they get older than they do in high school. Cliques dominate in high school.
When you go to a restaurant.
Maybe you weren't in a clique.
When you go to a restaurant.
Were you in a clique?
No, I was clique free, but I was because I was clique excluded. It was not, believe me.
That's what I was trying to get
I would have gone to any clique that would have had me.
Exactly.
But unfortunately,
very cliquey in high school. What were you going to ask me about restaurants?
I have no idea. Let's go to Megan. Oh, sorry. Let's go. We'll get to you
Claire
in a second, Megan.
In Worcester.
Hi, Claire.
Hi.
Hi.
I think you're right on with it. I think you're right on. I want to say two things. I live in the section of Worcester that is considered the wealthy section.
Yep.
Really not anymore. But it's diverse also. But there's two groups. There's the older people, and then there's the younger people who are diverse. And the interesting thing is I have a son who's not white. And when he would walk around the neighborhood, they would ask him if he belonged.
Yeah.
The police would stop him and ask
We've heard a lot of those stories. You know who wrote about that story in a book about his moving to Milton? He was he's the governor of Massachusetts as a young kid when he got into Milton Academy, walking to a friend's house. Claire, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. What's that?
Remember the great story about the valedictorian from the Weston High School that was stopped by the cops in his own driveway?
Oh, in his own driveway, was it? Well, there are a lot of those. But again, I don't want – this is – to me, that's racism. I'm not talking about conscious or overt racism or classism. I'm talking about just sort of a subliminal relationship we have with the world.
There was a great story, and we talked about it here a few months ago, how many white people would count an African-American among their close friends, and very few of us do. And because we just don't. I mean, we don't have them through work. We don't have them through school.
No, but you keep saying that, and you were totally at least missing my perspective. I am saying that a lot of people have tremendous exposure at work and around their lives with people who are different from them, different colors of their skin, different economic backgrounds. Some went to college, some didn't. I'm saying even despite that exposure, I don't see many people integrating that into their lives. The only hopeful sign from this Harvard study about people on commuter rail is what they don't get into is while they're not so tolerant up front, they're a little resistant, they get more tolerant later. Does that translate in anything in terms of their non-commuter rail lives? And I don't see it much, but maybe others do.
Jacqueline from Dorchester, the diverse Dorchester. What's your perspective, Jacqueline?
Hey, Jacqueline. Jacqueline, we're going to put you on hold for 1 second. We'll get back to you. Meg, you're
okay.
You're there.
Go ahead, Jacqueline. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, hi. Second time talking to you guys.
Good to talk to you.
I'm from New York City, and I grew up in a really diverse area.
Where'd you grow up in New York?
In the Bronx.
Uh-huh.
Everybody on my street, I was related to half the people on my street, but the other half were, Irish, Scottish, Italian, Puerto Rican, everybody, and people looked out for each other's kids. Then I moved to a project, same thing, small housing project. Then I came up here, and I learned a thing or two about the Balkans. Only then when I went to Europe and traveled over there, I realized that Boston had it even more so. Because you've got all these college students that, you know, you say you've got this very international thing, right? But they all stay together. They don't really, unless you send your kids to a diverse school and teach them about it and have different people in their lives from the very beginning, that's not going to set them up for a life where they're comfortable with other people and where they depend on other people for their interactions and for their well-being, their friends.
Yeah.
And In New York, every time I go back to New York, I say, I don't have to think in another language anymore because I talk to everybody there. I talk to anybody there. That's what I love about New York City is I don't have to go out of my way to interact with people who are different from me. Whereas here in Boston, I feel as though it's either you have to live in one of those quote-unquote diverse neighborhoods or you have to really
work at it.
Jacqueline, are you talking about, because I'm always struck when you go to other cities, you see much more of a big black middle class than you do in Boston. You see, it's really bizarre how few people you see, like in the Back Bay or downtown and stuff. But in Dorchester, it is pretty mixed ethnically, mixed racially, mixed economically, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. And that's part of the reason I live here.
Yeah.
But I would have to say that there's another little hitch to my story is that we are not Christians. We are not at all religious. As a matter of fact, we're atheists. And try to find some more black atheists to hang out with in Boston. Why don't you? You want to be in a little
tiny... What are you wearing, like a scarlet letter A on yourself, Jacqueline? Hey, Jacqueline, that's a great call. Thank you. Do a call again soon. We appreciate it.
There's a great story the other day about AA, which has the whole religious thing going on, the 12 steps thing, how there's now an atheist AA.
Is that true?
Yeah, for those people who do not want to get involved with the God part while they're trying to deal with their addiction problems. Tony from Worcester. What do you think, Tony?
Hi. I'm just having a slight issue with some of the language that's being used to describe the way that people coalesce socially, like saying that, do you gravitate towards people who are like you or aren't like you? How is likeness determined? Because someone that is of a different race isn't different from you. They're just distinguishable from you. And everybody is distinguishable. It doesn't mean that they are different.
Well, yeah, I hear you. But we're not conducting a study. We're just having a conversation. And I think what we meant different.
Right.
No, it doesn't mean finish. We mean different in the most casual of ways. They look different. They come from different backgrounds. They have different economic statuses.
Yeah.
Statuses or stati, whatever it is.
I don't know.
That sort of thing. So if we're doing the Harvard study, Tony, we'd probably embrace your notion. But for purposes of this discussion, I think we're taking it much more simply and basically. But Tony, thanks for the call. Let's go to Belmont, where Meg is on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call, Meg. Hi.
Hi. I'm a young mother and previously was a teacher. I'm not teaching now, and taught in a very diverse school in California, in San Francisco, and also here in Belmont. And I find it difficult in my daughter's kindergarten class. There's a number of Asians and Indians and some children who are interracial, mixed race. And at the birthday parties and everything, because of my determination as a mother and because of the background I've had teaching, I really, really make an effort to try to bridge the gap.
Mm-hmm.
That is a natural gap. I mean, I read the book, Why Do All the Black Kids Sit Together in the Cafeteria? And that's what happens. And I find it difficult primarily because of language, here anyway.
Do you mean language literally, or what do you mean by language?
Like actually understanding what the people are saying.
Okay.
So I'm talking to, people who have English as a second language, who have immigrated here. And the more I do it, the easier it is for me. But I purposely go outside of the circle of white mothers who are talking to each other so I can step over and talk to some of the Asian moms. I mean, my daughter's really good friends with their kids. And it is sometimes difficult for me to understand what they're saying and probably vice versa. But I purposely take that leap over. And also same with some of the Indian immigrants.
You've decided consciously to work at this.
I do agree that it is a natural, it naturally happens. It's what you see. And
right, unless you make the extra effort, as you're doing. Yeah.
Right?
What's that?
I'm the exception of the of the mothers who are standing around talking. So, go over there and start talking to someone who speaks a different language and looks different than me.
Hey, Meg, thanks for the call, and thanks for your doing it. Hey, Gina, you're in Taunton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Gina.
Hi, how are you?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Well, I'm a white gay woman. I work in the straight world, but in my social life, I
hang out with people just like me.
You mean other gay white women?
They might be a little more diverse than just white, but yeah, with other gay women. And sometimes gay men.
So how come?
The social world. I don't know, because I used to live in the straight world, so I know a lot of straight people, but I guess it's about what we have in common, maybe.
Yeah.
Is it a comfort zone thing, Gina, or how conscious is it?
I'm comfortable at home. I'm comfortable at work. I'm completely out at work. But socially, I choose to be with people who like me. I don't know why. It's not comfort. I'm comfortable with everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, my kids are straight, my family's straight, and all my friends. I have one very close straight friend, but she's a friend since childhood.
Gina, I wonder, because you see this a lot with gay couples that have kids, where a lot of gay couples that have kids hang out together because it's kind of fun for the kid, or not fun, really. I mean, I suppose it is fun, but it's great for the kids to see other kids whose parents are also gay. Is that part of it, do you think?
When my kids were younger, I used to go to groups where there were other gay parents. But, I mean, I found there's really no difference in straight parents, honestly.
Yeah.
All parents are the same. But
pretty boring, really.
They were in the group, just hung out in order for their kids to see that this was okay, because you are in the minority. When my kids were in school and, you know, I was the one lesbian couple, then my kids, I thought maybe they'd think I was the only. It wasn't normal. So
yeah.
I'd hang out with other lesbians, other gay men with kids, and hang out just so my kids would see it wasn't just them and us.
Hey, Gina, thanks for sharing your story with us. We appreciate it. Let's go to Putnam, Connecticut, where Phil is on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Phil.
Hi, how are you today?
We're excellent. Thank you for calling.
Good. Thanks for taking the call. You know, it's such a delicate subject, I guess, in some respects, because to what degree do you integrate your life into somebody else's? You know, I mean, am I forced to take a Chinese person home or?
No, we're not talking about mandates here, Phil.
I don't know, Jim. Maybe you'd like to pass some laws about this.
We're just trying to describe reality as different people see it and try to explain it a little bit. We're not suggesting unless there is overt decisions to exclude certain kinds of people from your life for evil kinds of reasons. We don't really care what people do. We're just trying to comment on it. So what do you bring here, Phil?
I have an experience of many years in a correctional setting, mm-hmm. In a correctional facility. Extremely diverse. And I've seen the worst that people can bring.
Yeah.
And, you see that, and it allows you to see people for who they are. And it has nothing to do with the color of their skin or their nationality. It's just people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how people act. And you can see that. I'm no longer in a correctional setting, but, you know, I can see that in Walmart. I can see that, you know, at the Pub 99. And you treat people based on who they are, and you interact with people based on who they are. There are some people that I see that I don't want to interact with, and it has nothing to do with any distinguishing feature about them. It has to do with simply because they're loud and obnoxious.
That's why I've been excluded from a lot of gatherings also. Phil, thank you for sharing your story with us.
You know, we were just talking about the minimum wage, the debate about the minimum wage.
We're going to talk about it again with Nancy King at the end of the show.
But I think that's one of the things that, the old line about walking a mile in somebody's shoes. I mean, a lot of people say, can't raise the minimum wage, going to take away all these jobs and stuff. And then you actually talk to someone, or you live next to someone, or someone in your family is trying to live on the minimum wage, and you have a much greater understanding of how hard that is. It's like the people that were trying to live on food stamps.
And John Polanowicz, who I had on last night, the head of Health and Human Services, when he went on the same food stamps budget and diet for a week.
And one of the great things about being a reporter is you get to go around and ask nosy questions of people who are very different from you, but don't you feel so it helps?
Didn't we have this conversation? Do we have the conversation here? I'm sorry, or was it on TV about the story in the New York Times the other day about the head of the board. Oh, with Emily, with the head of the Board of Corrections in Colorado, who put himself in solitary confinement for 22 hours.
Yes.
And all of a sudden is now for essentially banning solitary confinement.
So I think that's,
because it's not an abstract notion anymore.
Obviously, one of the good results of trying to put yourself in situations
I agree
that,
that
are outside your comfort zone. Where are we
going, take one more. Jim? Adam, you're in a car. You're our final call on this on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Adam. What's up?
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. First time caller.
I just want to say that I'm
Black American, and I just want to say that I think for us, it's very difficult with this notion of acting Black versus acting white, because that's like a concept that really doesn't exist. Like the correctional officer said, people are people. So then it's like for Black people, we're often told that we're acting white when we are talking correctly or dressing appropriate or fitted, and you know, especially when we're making some money and become successful, it's like, oh, you're acting white,
yeah.
You know, and people don't want to hear that, so it becomes hard to bring the things I've learned at my job to outside to my friends.
You know, I don't mean to be quoting endlessly from Deval Patrick's book, but since I did already, one of the best stories in his book, Adam, which I think you can relate to, is he has his first semester. He's obviously growing up pretty poor in Chicago. He has one semester at Milton Academy. He comes home. Remember this, Marjorie?
Yes.
His sister says to him disparagingly, "You talk like a white boy." And his grandmother, who raised them, interrupts and says, no, he speaks like an educated boy, which I thought was just great. Adam, thanks for the call. We really appreciate it. So even though we are not enamored of the study, it did provoke a pretty decent conversation.
It's brilliant conversation.
You know,
Jim,
by the way, while you were talking a second ago, I happened to catch the headline on CNN, and it said, "Following acquittal, blind man gets his guns back." That's hard. It's really... It's heartening, is
well,
it not?
You know, he has his Second Amendment rights
as
well.
Yeah, I guess he does.
Jim. Maybe the targets are, I don't know.
I'll leave that one alone.
I think
it's better you did.
Up next, we continue our round of interviews with the gubernatorial candidates. We're going to be joined by State Treasurer Steve Grossman. Stay tuned for that conversation. 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
A St. Patrick's Day Celtic sojourn on stage is like a gathering in a kitchen or the back room of a pub. We assemble musicians and dancers and singers and invite the audience to be a part of it. So it's very, very relaxed, very collaborative, and has a lot of surprises like you would imagine in a good night session around St. Patrick's Day in Ireland.
Tickets are on sale now. For more information, visit wgbh.org/Celtic.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And Innuendo in Natick, celebrating the Hunter Douglas Energy Smart Style Window Fashions event, featuring Hunter Douglas Duet Arcatella Energy Efficient Shades, along with Silhouette and Luminette Shading Systems. Innuendo.com. And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We are continuing our interviews with the gubernatorial candidates. Joining us in Studio 3, is State Treasurer Steve Grossman. Treasurer Grossman, it's good to see you.
Thank you, Jim. Marjorie,
thanks for having me back.
Thank
you very much for coming in. So Jim and I have carefully organized this interview. We're going to start with politics and get to policy. But before we get to either, I understand that you were spotted going door to door on the streets of Cambridge the other night by my colleague here, Mr. Browdy.
I'm driving down a street in darkness last night, a couple of nights ago in Inman Square. Snow is all over the place. It is freezing. And who do I see walking, appears to be going door to door in Cambridge, but a candidate for governor. And I look at him, and who is it but Steve Grossman? Is that what you were
well,
going door to door?
I was actually not going to door
to door. What were you doing?
There was a ward committee that was
having a little
meet and greet with candidates. And so I was told that there was great homemade cake and all kinds of good stuff. And you know me, sweets, no matter where the sweets are, I'm going to go chase them.
Ooh.
So I went in and had a good opportunity for good conversation. You know, the best kinds of conversations in a political campaign are not when you're giving a speech.
I agree with that.
It's when you're actually listening to other people and then responding. And it was a great conversation. We talked about climate change, jobs, the economy, housing, homelessness, affordability. It was a great conversation.
You know, I can't believe this. You're a supposed reporter here. He's telling me that
Steve
Grossman
is
going door
enough.
To door. He has no idea what he's talking about. Turns out you were going to a particular event.
I was close enough.
It's okay.
I looked like I was going door to door.
You know, speaking of work committees.
Maybe go to Ryle's on the corner for a little music or something instead.
You know, speaking of going to a ward committee, the caucuses are now in full swing. And for the 400th time, we've explained it. The caucuses are the places which elect delegates. The delegates go to the convention in June, and everybody who wants to be on the September primary ballot's got to get 15% of the votes. Currently, the reports suggest you're getting crushed in the polls, but you're winning the delegates.
Mm-hmm.
Is the spin that's happening on this delegates not your worst nightmare? Every candidate and every reporter and every columnist says Grossman is running away with this convention thing. If you don't run away with this convention thing, you're in deep whatever, aren't you?
Well, this is all about organizing. In my view, how do you win campaigns? You win campaigns by being organized. Ask Elizabeth Warren, bring her in here and say, Elizabeth, what's the most important thing that happened in your campaign? She would say the explosion of organizing and turnout in all the older industrial cities and the neighborhoods of Boston. She said people came out of the woodworks to vote and support because they believed that the ideas that we were talking about mattered in their lives.
So are those reports right? Are you winning significantly in this delegate count
issue? I think we're doing well in the caucuses and the organizing, and I think that's not surprising. Look, I've spent my life organizing. I mean, I've been an organizer. Look, when I was chairman of the Democratic National Committee back when Bill Clinton was president, I never gave up my seat on the Ward 7 Newton Democratic City Committee because you got to keep your ear to the ground. And when you put your ear to the ground, you hear a lot of things. You hear jobs, homelessness, housing, transportation. You hear deep, deep-seated concern about the direction in which we're going. And what are you, Governor, going to do about it? And so I think the organizing piece of this campaign is in full swing. We're doing well. I hope we continue to do well because I believe that the best organized candidate on the 9th of September in the Democratic primary will be the nominee the next morning. I really believe that.
We're talking with Treasurer Steve Grossman, who's running for governor on the Democratic side. For people who don't know, what actually does this mean, though? It means that you go to little gatherings of little political groups in little towns all across the state. I mean, do you go there for dinner? Do you go there for lunch? Do you go there for coffee? What do you do?
Well, they're all different. For example, I went last Sunday to Ward 9 in Worcester.
Yep.
And 90 people showed up. To elect 10 delegates.
Wow.
And we brought people. Another candidate brought people. There was a lot of conversation. You shake a lot of hands. You meet a lot of people. You have a lot of interesting conversations. You learn and you listen. I've only learned when I listen, not when I'm talking. And at the end of the day, we won all the delegates at that ward because we organized it more effectively. And that group of 10 delegates who will come to the convention in Worcester are going to support me, and my hope is we'll do very well at the convention and go on with a lot of momentum to a primary that will be all about organizing. But it's also about the power of ideas to change people's lives.
Did you have food?
It was a little bit of food. It was mostly not about the food.
Okay. I just wondered if there were hors d'oeuvres or pastries.
Now, yesterday when I went to Taunton and went to a vocational technical school, the kids in the culinary arts program, they made me a homemade chocolate ice cream cake with Oreo cookie crust and chocolate ice cream in their new homemade ice cream maker. Now, that to me is a great day when I can have for breakfast at 9 o'clock in the morning homemade chocolate ice cream cake.
Okay. I want to talk about vocational schools and community colleges, which I know is part of your jobs agenda in a second. But one more political. I've known you for a very long time. When last week I read you, you may not like the word attack, criticizing Martha Coakley for what you say are flip-flops on things like three strikes and you're out, mandatory minimum sentences. That wasn't you to me. How comfortable are you? I mean this sincerely. How comfortable are you? You're usually good at promoting yourself and promoting the things you believe in. How comfortable are you criticizing another candidate with whom you serve, by the way? She's the attorney general. You're the treasurer. Are you okay doing that, or does it feel it's sort of like an out-of-body experience?
No, listen,
no, I'm serious.
No, I know you're serious. And look, campaigns are about ideas and about our values, and we all evolve. We all change positions from time to time. I certainly have changed positions on issues over a period of time where I came to learn that the position that I had taken was not the right position and I should adopt a new one. But when I saw the Attorney General on issue after issue that has to do with criminal justice, three strikes, mandatory minimums, others as well, when I saw her continually changing her positions during the debates that we've had, and campaigns are about comparisons between candidates. I mean, after all, the voters are going to have to make a comparison and a judgment. So I simply pointed out that when the Attorney General makes so many changes in her position on so many issues that are fundamental to what she does as Attorney General, I begin to think that's probably a political decision on her part and not a matter of principle. And I think it's important to point that out to people.
Could the same thing be said about you, though, Steve Grossman, on this in-state tuition for the kids of illegal immigrants? You've been quoted regularly, an interview you did with Dan Ray on WBZ, in which you appeared to suggest, this is a couple of years ago, that you would not support the use of state funds for that purpose, and now you do. Is that political, or is that an evolution, or what is that?
Let me clarify. Okay. In 2006, I was proud to stand next to former Representative Marie St. Fleur and support in-state tuitions for children of undocumented immigrants. That's a position I've held consistently since then. In 2010, when I was running against Karen Pulido, she attacked me repeatedly for this position. And I simply said, look, you're wrong, Karen. We're not using taxpayers' money for this. These several hundred kids, and it may be 700 or 800 or 900 at the most, are not using taxpayer money. They're actually paying tuition. It's actually bringing revenue into the state. So we're not using taxpayer money. I wouldn't use taxpayer money. They're paying their own way at a reduced rate of tuition, and they're adding value to the state. Why would we leave a single young person out or a single person behind when these young people, children of undocumented immigrants, can get a good education and contribute to the economy? So it was really an attempt to clarify her misconception that we were not using taxpayer money. You got a few hundred kids, and we got 300,000 kids in our public colleges. So we're not using a dime of taxpayers' money. It's actually producing revenue for the taxpayers and not taking a single seat away from any other kids. Marjorie.
You know, one more political thing before we get to a policy. We've moved a little bit away from the caucuses. But one of the big theories is that Steve Grossman's campaign is going to help Juliette Kayyem get to that 15% threshold she needs to get on the ballot, because then there'll be two women battling it out as opposed to just one woman, Martha Coakley. And, of course, Juliette Kayyem thinks it's ridiculous that we have gone beyond this two-woman thing. But other people would say, oh, a lot of women that vote are older women, and they may be torn between two women. So are you helping Juliette Kayyem?
No, we haven't even talked about that. We're competing for every delegate that we can get, and this is a competitive business politics. Juliette's doing the same. I think Juliette's doing fine. She's a distinguished candidate, done a lot of good things in her life, and makes a compelling case for herself. I've enjoyed getting to know her on the campaign trail. But this is really about our competing for every delegate, because every one of those delegates is a grassroots activist who can help us organize in her or his respective community to help us win a primary in November and go on to defeat Charlie Baker in November. That's what my goal is.
Let's discuss something, Steve Grossman, that's obviously big in the news today. The people in Revere, hopefully a lot of them, are voting in a referendum to determine whether or not they will compete with Everett for the Eastern Massachusetts casino. Here's another difference between you and the person who's leading in the polls on the Democratic side. Martha Coakley has said she's not sure how she'd vote on a ballot question should it make its way to the ballot, which would repeal the whole casino law, which would mean no casinos, no slots, parlors, etc. You've been pretty strongly, I think it's fair to say, in favor of the law. At the same time, you run the lottery, the most successful lottery in the country, a lottery on which more dollars is spent per capita by the people of Massachusetts than any state in America by far. Why are you not worried that if casinos open and are successful, meaning a lot of people gamble and lose a lot of money, that it's not going to cannibalize a huge source of revenue for cities and towns, namely the lottery that you run?
So as you just said, and I think it's important that people understand this, the lottery is the most successful lottery in the United States, and the profits from the lottery go back to cities and towns in the form of unrestricted local aid, firefighters, police officers, senior centers, all the things that make up quality of life. So naturally, we're dedicated to making sure we maximize profits at the lottery. The best analysis of what would happen to the lottery has been done by the Mass Taxpayers Foundation, by Mike Widmer. And he says, net of any losses the lottery might suffer, we will still bring an additional roughly $300 million into the state. That would fully fund, for example, universal pre-K education for every 3- and 4-year-old in Massachusetts, if we chose to use the money for that purpose. So I did favor expansion of casino gambling in Massachusetts because it will create 15,000 jobs and $300 million of revenue. That's at a moment, by the way. We're sitting here talking, and there are 250,000 people out of work. So if we can put 15,000 of those men and women to work and give them good jobs with benefits, health benefits, pension benefits, that's a good thing. So I would, if a ballot question gets on the ballot, and it's in the courts now, I would vote against repeal because it was passed by the legislature, signed by the governor. any city and town that says, I don't want a casino, is not going to get a casino or a slot parlor. That's the way the law works. So I think the law is working pretty well. Revere may or may not decide. If they decide that they want a casino, then they'll compete with Everett, and the Gaming Commission will make that decision. So I think the law is working pretty well, and I'd just as soon like to see the law in place. The lottery will be fine. We will realize additional revenue, and we will invest that to improve the quality of life of most of our citizens.
You know, because I just, on a political level and a personal level, feel a little queasy about gambling in general and big casinos in Massachusetts. The idea of Charlie Baker always appealed to me. Let's have one casino and see how it works. We have the potential, of course, to have many casinos and at least how many slot parlors?
One slot parlor.
The law says you could have one slot parlor and up to three casinos.
Yeah,
that's not guaranteed, of course.
But it's a lot of casinos. I mean, what's wrong with Baker's idea?
Well, that may be as good an idea as any. The legislature and the governor came to an agreement, and it was signed by the governor. It's the law that we could have up to three. But the Gaming Commission could easily say, you know, it would oversaturate the market. So we are not going to vote for three casinos. We're only going to vote for two. There's also the possibility that one of the Indian tribes would be able to get their own opportunity for a casino, but that would require changes in Washington. So the law is fluid, depending upon what happens to the Indian tribes. But it is up to the Gaming Commission, and they are not required to vote for three. They're only required to vote for up to three, and that's their call, not mine.
You know, Steve Grossman, just one last thing on this gaming, as proponents call it, and gambling, as I guess critics call it. When Tom Birmingham was the chair of the Senate post-audit, whatever it's mm-hmm. called, committee years ago, he did this comprehensive study on the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And he not only demonstrated, I think for the first time I'd seen it, that it was, I think you were chair of the National Democratic Committee at this point, or something like that, that it was, again, we spend more dollars per capita than any place, but also there was sort of a Robin Hood in reverse, is that people in Chelsea and Holyoke and places like that spend much more per person than do people in Weston and Dover and that sort of thing. So you have people losing a ton of money on the lottery, and even though it does fund cities and towns, to make that extra $300 million on casinos, that means people have to lose hundreds of millions of dollars. Do you worry about the impact? Yes, it's creating jobs. Well, one can dispute how many, but it is clearly going to create some jobs. Do you worry about the impact on low and moderate income people? Because you spent a lot of your life working with low and moderate income
right.
people for decades.
I do worry about the impact and how it can harm people, particularly those who have a propensity to gambling addiction, and we do have gambling addiction. It's an illness, and it's something that we have to deal with, and we work with the compulsive gambling folks all the time to try to mitigate that.
Mm-hmm.
What I also have said is that I would not accept or support the expansion of online lottery gambling, which is something that the federal government allows, unless we deal with this issue of compulsive gambling. Says we don't need to go further in that direction. But let's remember, a significant part of the revenue that we would bring back to Massachusetts, this $300 million we're talking about, is money that Massachusetts people are already spending at Foxwoods
right.
and at Mohegan Sun and at Twin Rivers in Rhode Island and at other places. So this is, to some extent, repatriating money that people already decide of their own free will to spend in casinos in different parts of New England. So let's bring the money back here. Let's invest it in things that matter in people's lives. Let's implement the law as the law was contemplated, and I think the lottery will be fine. And at the end of the day, $300 million of additional revenue, but more important, 15,000 jobs. I'd like to see a lot of people put to work, because a lot of people have looked in the mirror for three consecutive winters in this state and have not had a job. What does that do to people's lives? Their mortgage payments, their car payments, their groceries, their kids, their families, their self-esteem. Put some people to work. That, to me, is the most important issue in this campaign. Jobs and economic security. Look, I've spent my life running a business creating jobs. When I became treasurer, I took that record of success, and I've done exactly that, creating a small business banking partnership, and we poured money into banks that are loaning money to businesses owned by women, people of color, immigrants, veterans, to try to help the small business sector of the economy grow. I want to take that record of success to the governor's office and help create jobs and economic security. That's what I'm running on. That's why I would like to be governor of the state.
The governor of the state has taken some heat in recent days about, you know, the health connector has been struggling and people aren't able to get their insurance, and the licensing of these medical marijuana facilities has been full of confusion and misrepresentations. And, of course, the Department of Children and Families, a lot of reporting by my newspaper, the Boston Herald, about troubles there. So if you were the governor today, many legislators have called for the resignation of Olga Roche, who runs the Department of Children and Families. Do you think she needs to go?
On the DCF crisis, and I would call it a crisis, here's my view. Governor has to establish fundamental principles that you're going to operate by. My principles are three. Safety of every child, accountability from top to bottom, from the commissioner to the social worker who was hired last week, and then reform. So there's an outside agency coming in here. They're analyzing this, and they're going to come with some recommendations that are going to be hopefully worked into the reform agenda. Last week, it was reported that Olga Roche had offered to resign. Had I been governor, I would have accepted her resignation. And then what I probably would have done, I probably would have picked up the phone and called former Chief Justice Margaret Marshall. And I would have said, Margie, I'd like you to come in here and work directly with me. I want you to oversee a reform agenda at DCF. You're a person who's of great wisdom and judgment. You are respected by every person in the state for the leadership role you played at the SJC when you were the Chief Justice. I would bring her in, have her work directly and report directly to me, oversee a reform agenda top to bottom, using the recommendations of the Welfare Child Welfare League that's doing this, so that we had a person of unquestioned judgment. Unfortunately, the people of Massachusetts have lost confidence in DCF. That's why it's a crisis.
Have you talked to her about this?
No, I haven't talked to her because I'm not the governor. It's not my – I would be overstepping the bounds. But you asked me what I would do as governor, and I think it's – running for governor is a lot about telling the people of Massachusetts, what kind of a governor would you be? How decisive would you be? How deeply engaged would you be in managing through a crisis and helping to solve problems? Marjorie, I've tried to be in the solutions business all my life. That's what I've done in business, in politics, in philanthropy, and now as state treasurer. That's why I'm running for governor, to be in the solutions business and to be strong and decisive and engaged every day in solving the problems that we face as a society to make Massachusetts a better place for every one of our citizens.
You know, Steve Grossman, so you've picked one example of an area where there's been some controversy, to say at least, not to mention tragedy, obviously, at least in the case of Jeremiah Oliver, a little 5-year-old boy from Fitchburg, where you would have made different decisions from the governor. Let's talk about the connector for a second. And while, as of a couple of weeks ago, the governor acknowledged there were as many as 50,000 applications that weren't in the system, apparently that number has dropped dramatically. Getting back to the likely Republican nominee, what Charlie Baker has said repeatedly, we wouldn't have any of these problems had the governor, meaning Deval Patrick, fought harder to get a waiver for Massachusetts. We had universal health care. It was running terribly well. The reason we're in this mess, and I'm paraphrasing what Charlie Baker's position is because we didn't fight like crazy with the Obama administration to say, we don't need to implement the Affordable Care Act. We need to stay with what we have. Is Charlie Baker right? Should we have gotten a waiver? Should we have just stayed with what was working rather than having the federal government's rules apply here?
Look, 2020 hindsight is great, and Charlie is operating. He's watching the game films on the
Well, he's been asking, in all fairness to Charlie Baker, he's been advocating for this waiver for a long time.
You see, I also have been strongly advocating for a waiver from the feds.
So you agree with him on that?
Different
issue.
Waiver, though. Okay. For me, the waiver was we had some very specific pilot programs that were going to reduce the cost of health insurance for small businesses
right.
by 10-15%.
Right. And those were denied by the president.
Those were denied. I would have continued to fight
for
that. I will continue to fight for that because that's just common sense, Jim. I'm a small business owner all my life.
I know that.
I talk to small business owners, and they talk about the cost of health care as being one of the reasons why they're not hiring more people and why they're not confident about the future. Look, we've got a serious problem in the state in terms of the way we procure technology. I mean, it's not just the connector that isn't working. We had other problems in unemployment insurance, for example. We've had other issues. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars. We'll spend billions of dollars on technology over the next few years. We've got to get the procurement of technology right because technology drives our society. And if we're not doing a good job in terms of how we oversee the way we procure technology that can serve the people of the state, that's a serious problem. So having been in business all my life, that's a subject I'm comfortable with. I'm not the governor yet. I hope to be governor. When I am governor, I will tell you that procurement of technology and other goods and services is going to be a particularly important area of focus for me.
So how much of this do you – again, you said when the governor – by the way, the place where the governor said not to be self-serving, but I'll feel free to do so. Well, the place where the governor said he was offered a resignation was actually here last Friday. You would have accepted the resignation, obviously done that differently. You talk about the procurement of technology should have been done differently with the connector unemployment insurance. The medical marijuana rollout, maybe 7 or 8 of the 20 that have gotten provisional approval – have either political connections that are raising some issues, misrepresentations by some of the alleged supporters who turn out not to be supporters, a whole variety of things. How much of all this do you lay at the feet of the current Democratic governor?
Look, we have some problems, and we've got to fix those problems, and I think it's the job of a governor to work with his team to fix them. He brought, I may be mispronouncing her name, Sarah Iselin in from Blue Cross to oversee the connector and to get that on track. And I think she's indicated some confidence that we're on a good pathway. I'd prefer to take a look at the governor's full 7.5 or almost 8 years. It'll be 8 years by the time he finishes and say, what did this governor do that put the people of Massachusetts in better shape when he leaves office than when he arrived? This is a governor who took this state and in 4 of the worst years in 75 oversaw a budget with optimism, was able to invest $1 billion in life sciences to create the best life sciences industry in the world, right here in Massachusetts, to be able to drive a process by which clean tech and green tech became an industry that now employs 80,000 people and over 5,000 companies. Our whole climate change approach and our reduction of greenhouse gas emissions under this governor has been exemplary. We're the best state in the country in terms of that issue. So I think this governor has done some extraordinary things that have put us on a pathway for growth and economic development for years to come. Are there problems? Absolutely. Do those problems need to be fixed? No doubt. Would I be a different governor with a different style? We all different. I'm a small business owner who was engaged every step of the way in my business in terms of fixing problems and solving the needs of customers. So we're different people. But let's not let the governor's 7-plus years of achievement go unnoticed, because I watch them. And I work with him, by the way. Highest bond rating in the state's history. I worked directly with him and his team. I saw how he operated to put this state on a strong financial footing. And that is saving the state hundreds of millions of dollars, which we can reinvest in other things. So a lot of good things have happened on this governor's watch. He's a partner of mine. I respect what he does. But these problems need to be fixed, no doubt, and you're absolutely right.
Is Martha Coakley a partner of yours, and do you respect what she's done as Attorney General?
Yeah, I think Martha Coakley has been a fine Attorney General. I think she's accomplished some noteworthy things. I'm running against her because I think, frankly, that the leadership that I have demonstrated in my life, in business, in philanthropy, and as state treasurer, have qualified me to be the kind of governor that the people of the state hopefully will want. That's what elections are all about.
Two quick last things from me, Treasurer Steve Grossman. You have been a small businessman and a big businessman. And you've done very well in your business all your life. What do you think about the minimum wage? Obama's wanting to raise the minimum wage across the country. Good for business or not?
I think it's good for business.
Okay. What about the jobs loss at the Congressional Budget Office?
I see that, but I also see 900,000 people getting out of poverty.
Okay.
And I think at the end of the day, minimum wage at this state, what the Senate president voted, the Senate's voted, it hasn't happened yet. I'm in favor of $11.
Okay.
And by the way, I would veto if a bill came to my desk and it increased the minimum wage to $11, but it also cut unemployment benefits for the workers in the state simultaneously. I would veto that bill. That's wrong. I'm proud of the unemployment benefits we have in the state.
That is the Charlie Baker position, I believe, is
No, it's a Speaker DeLeo position, is it not?
He wants
to reform the unemployment system.
Well, reform is okay, but don't cut unemployment benefits.
Okay.
We have 30 weeks of benefits. I'm proud of that. It may be the highest in the country, but it's the right thing to do. The feds cut the unemployment benefits for people, long-term benefits. We still have 30 weeks of here in Massachusetts. I'm proud of the fact that Massachusetts has 30 weeks of unemployment benefits.
And the last thing for me, John O'Brien is facing federal charges for allegations. He used to run the probation department, the allegations he was rigging hiring at the probation department. The Herald's reporting this morning that countless, quote-unquote, politicians have made immunity deals in this corruption case. And they've also reported like a who's who of every politician, Republican or Democrat in Massachusetts, that sponsored candidates for jobs at the probation department. Steve Grossman, have you sponsored people to probation department?
No, I have not.
You have not. Gee, you're one of the only ones that hasn't. Were you asked?
No.
You weren't asked. Okay.
I've ever met Mr. O'Brien.
Okay.
I wouldn't know him if I except for his picture in the Herald every day. I wouldn't probably know him if I bumped into him on the street.
So you don't need an immunity deal, obviously.
Look,
then.
The people of Mass. No, I don't hope
he
I don't
may
need
for
any
other
media.
Reasons, but not for that
okay.
reason.
But let me just a quick comment. I think when the people of Massachusetts see people getting positions of responsibility because of who they know,
yeah.
rather than did they deserve it or did they merit the job, it saps people's confidence in government. When we have so little trust in government and in the way government leaders on balance operate or handle themselves, that eats away at our ability to get things done. And one
so
of the
Attorney
things,
General Martha Coakley should not have recommended people for
those
jobs.
I don't think anybody should have done it, frankly.
Okay.
That's just a blanket statement. I think it should have been done. And I think the way these letters and phone calls were made, and my next-door neighbor just graduated from college and she needs a job and can you help me, that kind of stuff, most citizens say, I can't do that. I'm not in that kind of a position. The favored few seem to get privilege and positions. That's wrong, and I think people don't like it, and that should end. We ended at Treasury when I became treasurer. We changed our policies entirely. It was the right thing to do, and as governor, I would maintain a position whereby we did it based on merit. Hire the best people. When I got sworn in on January 19th of 2011 as state treasurer, I said two things. First, I'm going to hire the best people for every job, because that's what I did in business, and that's what everybody tries to do. Hire the best people for every job. And number two, I want hiring at Treasury to reflect the diversity of the society in which we live. And I'm proud that 35% of the people we've hired at Treasury and at the lottery in the last 3-plus years are people from diverse communities. That's what it means to reflect diversity and be inclusive. Leave no one out. Leave no one behind.
So
that's
I won't be calling Steve for a job anytime soon.
No, Jim. you in particular shouldn't call.
What's your website?
Marjorie can call anytime.
Thank you,
Treasury. Forget about it.
What's your website, Steve Grossman?
SteveGrossman.com, and I hope people will go on that online. Right. I hope people will call me and volunteer. We need all the volunteers we can get.
Good luck. Good to see you, Steve Grossman.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks,
Treasurer
Marjorie.
Grossman. We have been talking, of course, with State Treasurer Steve Grossman about his run for governor. Up next, we get an overview of the Winter Olympics from sports reporter Shira Springer. She's fresh back from the palm tree-studded beaches of Sochi. The conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Beth Daly is a reporter with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
WGBH is a perfect fit for us. It is a young newsroom. It has lots of energy. It has TV. It has radio. And it has really smart people with really great ideas that we hope to collaborate on.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now a partner with WGBH News.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesleyuniversity.edu. And the Museum of Science, where you can step inside the Hall of Human Life and exhibit you and discover how everyday human behavior affects our brains, our bodies, and the world around us. Details at mos.org/exhibityou.
Wow.
Whoa, that was the weirdest music interlude I've ever heard. In any case, welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3. I guess she's fresh from the land of palm trees, honey beer, anti-gay laws, Shira Springer. She's an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. She's been in Sochi covering the Winter Olympics. And last time we actually talked to her, she had just crawled out of a Sochi hotel window to get to do her work. Shira, it's great to see you again.
Good to see
Welcome
you.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And, you know, before we get to the Olympics, there's just a couple of funny things I have to ask you about in your stories about this. You said there was the legendary Ring of Steel actually was neither ring nor steel. What was the deal?
That is correct. It was very strange. From everything that I had heard leading up to the Olympics, I expected that it would be very tight security, that we'd be seeing armed guards almost from the moment we left the airport, just outside of the Olympic complexes. But no, you kind of went along, and there were a couple of guards in a guardhouse, and there was a turnstile to get into my hotel compound, and there was a fence around my hotel compound. But the guards weren't really that attentive. You could have gone under the barriers. You could have.
They were sleeping at some points, right?
Yeah, I showed up once at 4 a.m. This is a regular bus stop, and the bus dropped me off, and they were sleeping, and I just knocked on the window, and they let me through. But it was very bizarre. There were I think from what I could gather, the real concern was in the mountains.
Yeah.
That terrorists would make their way over the mountains, or that they were hiding out in the mountains or would hide out in the mountains. So the coastal areas, I would say, were a little bit lax outside of the Olympic Park. But I definitely noticed that when I got up to the mountains, it was security checks, you know, getting up into the mountain media complex, getting up to every venue. You had multiple security checks.
Okay.
There were little guard posts stationed on the mountains. But, you know, down in the coastal area, not so much.
You know, you wrote a piece sort of wrapping up your experience. It was great. And one of the stories, it's funny because Margie and I were both talking about it this morning, and we both cited the exact same example that we loved about how solicitous the volunteers and the Russian workers were. It was your salad experience. Can you share that?
Yes, that was great.
Can you share that with the listeners who haven't read your piece yet?
So, yeah, bobsled had just finished up, women's bobsled, and I was starving. So I go to the venue cafeteria, and the chef comes out, and I just want a salad. All I want is a salad. And I didn't want any dressing, but they were very, very insistent. And so I refused a couple times, and then finally the chef yells at me, "Woman, sauce, please." and then he points to two bottles, one with mayonnaise and one with ketchup.
Oh,
and I'm looking
God.
At him like, huh? And then I figured out, oh, this is a make-your-own DIY Russian dressing situation.
That's terrific. And there were a couple other culinary things that you talked about.
There are cabbage, a lot of culinary things.
Yeah, cabbage for breakfast. What's that about?
Oh, everything seemed to have a little bit of cabbage in it. They had some hot cabbage there was meat and cabbage, which seemed to be the predominant theme at every meal. So sometimes there were like pastries stuffed with cabbage.
Really?
For breakfast. Then there was this sort of like stewed cabbage with some kind of pork meat. I'm not really sure.
Was it good?
I didn't try it.
Okay.
And then there was, which was very good, this creamy cabbage coleslaw-y salad, but much fresher and much lighter, with cabbage, a cream-like dressing, and corn. And it was native with these herbs that are native to the area.
You know what it's great with? Ketchup and mayo. Actually,
I'm
you
sure.
should try it.
I'm sure.
Let's talk about the Americans at the Olympics. You were there. You talk right about the immediate aftermath of the women's hockey team losing to Canada in the finals. And obviously the reason it was particularly dramatic is not only losing to Canada, but losing after being up 2-0 with, 3.5 minutes to go or something. It's tied in regulation. They lose in overtime. You would think a silver medal is just spectacular, but obviously a silver medal when you can taste the gold medal. What was that like for these women? Isn't the captain from Dedham or somewhere?
The captain is from Danvers.
Danvers. I knew it was one of the D places.
Something like 19 of the 21 players, some number like that, have some connection to the Massachusetts slash New England area, whether
really?
They went to prep school here to hone their hockey skills or went to college here.
Or live here.
Exactly.
So what was that like with these women immediately
it
after?
It was pretty amazing. It was quite depressing and devastating and heartbreaking to see these women. You know, you saw them at the medal ceremony. They were just in tears. I mean, it was the most sorrowful, somber group of silver medalists you might ever see. I mean, this is a group that has not won, you know, the women's hockey team, U.S. women's hockey team, a gold medal since the 1998 Nagano Games when the sport made its Olympic debut. And you were thinking,
have they lost to Canada every time since?
They lost. Right? Well, they lost to Canada every time since except 2006, where they actually were upset in the semifinals and played for bronze.
I see. Okay.
But you know, everybody thought this was a really special team. You know, they had beaten Canada 4 times in a row leading up to the Olympics in these really intense exhibition games where there were brawls and tons of penalty minutes. And Canada was in disarray coming into the tournament. Their coach had resigned 2 months before the games. And Kevin Dineen, a former NHL player and NHL coach, took over on the fly. So everybody thought this was the Americans' opportunity. And here you are, 3.5 minutes to go, and you're thinking, they've got this. And it was complete shock. And yet they come, and you have to go into this area called the mix zone, where you meet with the media. And this was no more than perhaps 45 minutes or so, 50 minutes or so after the actual loss, and maybe 15 minutes or so after they had received their silver medals. So they're walking in with their silver medals around their neck, these bouquets of flowers that they get, and they're all crying and teary-eyed.
And the gold medal winner Canadians are right next
to
them, right?
Exactly. And the gold medal winning Canadians with their medals and flowers are standing, you know, feet away from them talking about how wonderful it is to win gold again.
Oh, no.
And these women were stand up athletes at this point. They talked. They did not shy away from the tough questions. It was really, really quite impressive. And I'll say this, too. Impressive, especially in the wake of the fact that I went to the halfpipe competition where Shaun White finished fourth.
The flying tomato, as we know and love him.
Exactly. Yeah. The most recognizable snowboarder in the world. And he ducked out of his media obligations in the mix zone and needed about an hour and 15 minutes before he realized, you know, and the people who represented him realized, you know, we need to speak to people about this. But the women's hockey team spoke. They, you know, were accountable for what happened.
And it did happen. I mean, it was just dumb luck at the end. The Canadians just got lucky.
I think they kind of, you know, took it for granted. I don't want to say maybe not took it for granted, but thought they had it in hand. I mean,
yeah.
They were up, I think it was something like 54.6 seconds up by one goal at that point. And I think they started thinking gold medal, we've got it, all right. And they didn't quite celebrate, but they were getting ahead of themselves,
yeah.
Even that little bit. And then to regroup after Canada ties it up that quickly, I think was just a difficult task.
We're talking with Shira Springer from the Boston Globe, who was over covering the Olympics in Sochi. So tell us about this little 18-year-old skier. She's terrific.
She is terrific. I mean, she's terrific on the snow, but she's also terrific off the snow.
Michaela Schifrin,
yeah. Correct. She's 18 years old. She's the new face of U.S. skiing. She is going to probably, I would say almost assuredly, if she stays healthy, be all of the win records and title records and Olympic records and World Cup records that Lindsey Vonn has set. She is that good, that young.
Does that mean she has to date Tiger Woods too or not?
Gosh, I hope not.
Okay, I just want to be clear if that was part
No, I
of
think
the
she
deal.
Has a very good head on her shoulders. You can interpret that as you may.
Yeah.
But she is phenomenal. And what's great about her is she is really, really grounded. I mean, she is a phenomenal athlete, but she comes off the slopes and she's just really honest and upfront. She almost blew it in her last run. She completely lost her balance. Her left ski comes flying out during her final slalom run. She had gold really in hand by a large margin. She had to just really complete this second run, almost blew it. And she comes down, she says, yeah, I thought I lost it there.
Was she the one that talked about visualizing everything?
Yes.
Yeah, tell people about that.
She did. She talked about, she said to the media before she ever competed, she says, I know you all think this is my first Olympics, but I've been here 1,000 times in my head. So for me, this is my 1,000th Olympics. And everything that can possibly happen, win, lose, crash, I've thought about, played through in my mind, so I'm prepared. So once she won...
She's 18.
Yeah. I mean, really, really precocious in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So when she won, I asked her at the press conference, I said, so, Michaela, you know, you've visualized everything. How does what you visualized compare to reality? And she said, I'm not really sure this is reality right now.
That's great.
You know, but that's how she was. I mean, she just has a very mature attitude about everything. And it's wild to think that this is a girl, you know, a young woman who still travels around Europe on the World Cup circuit with her mother, because she needs her mother there to help her with all the sort of little daily things that you, an 18-year-old, might be confused about.
Well, you know, that's what I've never been to an Olympics, and I really do want to go.
Brazil.
Ultimately, when's Brazil? Oh, Brazil, this is the next round, right?
Exactly. That has your name written on it.
I think I could actually cover it for WGBH.
That's
can
right.
you talk to the
we'll
boss,
see what
Marjorie?
We can do for you, Jim.
I'm glad you made the comments you did about Michaela Schifrin. What are, other than the superstars, other than the flying tomato and the people who have huge ad contracts, are these normal people? I mean, are they accessible people? Are they huge egomaniacs who are swollen by all the NBC attention? What's the, I know it's hard to generalize. What are they like?
Very normal, almost exceedingly normal for the most part, outside of the big celebrities that
yeah.
you mention, the celebrity athletes. I mean, for the most part, the people who are doing bobsled, extraordinarily normal. I mean, that was another wonderful post-event media mix zone experience where, you know, they just wanted to talk. I mean,
the guy from Massachusetts and the other
guy? The guy from Massachusetts, but also the women. And there's a superstar in there, too, Lolo Jones, who was, famous for being a summer Olympian.
Track star, right? Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, the bobsledders, I don't think they'd seen more than 3 or 4 or 5 reporters at an event, you know, the whole season that they compete. I mean, it goes on and nobody knows or writes about it. And they're just like, oh, my gosh, there are people here who want to talk to us about what we do. I'm so excited. And you would bump into these people also just wandering, the athletes, wandering the
Well, you said you were running besides a gold medalist.
Yeah, yeah, I was running. And he's like, oh, you seem like you got a good pace. Let's run a bit together. And I was like, sure. And we start talking. He's
okay.
Training.
What was your pace? Don't tell me it was like 6 minute miles.
No. It was like 7:15. So
still pretty fast.
Should be ashamed.
Pretty fast.
You know, we're talking to Shira Springer from the Boston Globe. You know, Shira, when I read your rap piece entitled "Sochi's Charm," strength was out in full force. I was really enjoying it, and I was getting nervous as I was getting further in it. I said, God, I hope this is not going to be this celebration of how wonderful things are in Russia, and we're just going to hear the hospitality was spectacular. They fixed the dog problem and all that sort of thing. I mean, we've all seen
fixed.
Pussy Riot being whipped by some of these people.
Terrible.
Well, I would argue the way they treated humans was
Pussy Riot.
But then you tell the story, which I love, about you say, but I know that much of what I saw was for show, that Putin put on his friendliest face for these games. And then you tell the story about a snowboarder who, of course, I'd never heard of before, this Canadian snowboarder, Michael Lambert. Describe what happened at that press conference for his team.
He's a Canadian snowboarder. There was a press conference for the entire team. And as this press conference is wrapping up, he says, what? No controversy, no questions about controversy, no questions about the real issues here. And none of the reporters who were present said anything. And he goes in and sort of launches into this monologue about, you know, we're safe here because a man of great power says we're going to be safe here. We believe what these people in power are telling us. But don't be lulled into, you know, thinking that everything is fine here. There is controversy. There is problems. There's a whole political context here that should be thought about, addressed, and talked about. And don't forget that. And
So has anything changed? I mean, they leave. They spend their $51 billion. He has the star turn that he was hoping for. There's no terrorism within Sochi. Most people say the games themselves, including you, were quite wonderful.
The bar was set very low.
Well,
though.
Maybe it was.
You know, I was like, no terrorism attack, no athlete deaths, and we're doing well here. You know?
Yeah. So, but and some great competition.
And some great
competition. So what is Russia different after whatever, 17 days or 19 days than it was 3 weeks ago?
I don't think Russia politically is different. I will say this, though. You know, they won the medal count. I think Russia spiritually is somewhat different in the sense that it's a very prideful people that doesn't often have much to take pride in. And there was a tremendous, tremendous outpouring of pride from the ordinary citizenry. I mean, every day you saw people in the Olympic Park with the Olympic, with the Russian flag rather, you know, painted on their cheeks, waving the Russian flag, dressed in Russian national cultures. So I think in a good way, it was a morale boost for the people. I think it's unfortunate that it also feeds into the propaganda that Putin puts out there about this being the modern face of Russia, because I'm under no illusion that this is indeed the modern face of Russia. This is the face that Putin wanted to show the world. And, you know, I wish there was more opportunity to say more and do more and write more about the political controversy, but there is always a fine line that you walk as an Olympic reporter, because you are there for a sports event, an international sports festival. And yet it cannot be separated from the political context, but you have it's a very difficult line to walk. At any Olympics, it was that way in China. It was that way in London with issues. It was that way in Vancouver with issues.
Well, I'll see how it is in Brazil when I go. Hey, before you go, from one strange place, Sochi, to another, we only have 30 seconds left. You're chairing some workshop at MIT on what exactly are you doing?
Not sharing, hosting a panel.
Whatever.
Yes.
What is it?
It's the annual MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, where a lot of big names and bright people in the world of sports and sports business gather to talk about how analytics, data, statistics are being used today in the sports world. I'm moderating a panel on athlete analytics. One of the members of the panel is going to be the quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts, Andrew Luck.
Whoa.
Oh,
so
great.
It's going to be a really fantastic discussion about what statistics mean to athletes and for training purposes, for injury prevention. And there are a ton of other great topics on the agenda at this conference.
By the way, you can find out about the agenda. Go to SloanSportsConference.com. Welcome home. You did great reporting, as did your colleagues.
Yeah, we love reading stuff from over there, Shira. Shira Springer is an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Up next, is the clothing giant The Gap practicing smart retail policies by raising the minimum wage for their workers? Nancy Kane joins us for that conversation, listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
A Hollywood dream come untrue?
We had four or five funerals a week. You didn't go out and party. You went home and learned how to hang IV poles.
William Wayborn, former president of the Dallas Gay Alliance, talking about the reality of the Oscar-nominated Dallas Buyers Club and why he's still rooting for the movie to win a statue. On The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Secrets of the Vatican from WGBH's Frontline. Get an account of Benedict's final days as Pope and Francis's battle to set the Church on a new path. Watch Frontline, Tuesday at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Democrats think they are winning the minimum wage fight nationally, despite that study from the, as I said, the John King this morning, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, saying that it will cost America a half a million jobs. And while legislative battle still rages, some big corporations in America on their own are raising the minimum wage of their employees. Here to talk about the public and private sector part of this major debate in America, in Studio 3 is Nancy Kane. You know Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Good to see you again, Nancy.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for being here, Nancy. Well, as Jim just talked about, this report that says that people are going to raise the minimum wage is going to cost people jobs, and the other side says it's going to lift all these people out of millions of people out of poverty. So
the study actually says both, right?
Yeah,
it's going to do both things.
It's going to do both things. So where are you? You're a historian at Harvard Business School. You're at the Harvard Business School. Where are you on this?
And where should America be on this?
I don't actually think this one is terribly complicated, and nor are the polling numbers on this. More than 75% of Americans support, a real rise in the minimum wage. And I think that gets back to, some very strong, if you will, currents in the body politic, or, oxygenating systems in the body politic, which is people should be paid decently, fairly, for a fair day's work. And no matter how you slice the numbers at $7 and change an hour, no matter how many hours you work, piecing it together with two jobs, as millions of Americans do, you can barely scrape you and your family up to the poverty line. So we've got a prevailing standard here that doesn't allow Americans to, live a decent life, take care of their kids, and let's be, pragmatic about it, be sustained, viable consumers in the American economy. And this is part of a larger debate about income distribution that we've touched on, that you folks talk about, a great deal on the show. It's a very important debate, but this is a piece of it. And it gets, again, to these very fundamental aspects of what constitutes decent remuneration in a society that likes to believe it was founded on hard work and pulling yourself ahead by your own efforts.
I'm not surprised at all by the tenor or the content of the legislative debate. I think the whole thing is totally predictable. And as John King from CNN told us this morning, it's unlikely that Congress is going to do anything on this, at least prior to the midterm elections. What I am fascinated by is when companies like The Gap and Costco and Whole Foods, Beloco,
In-N-Out Burger,
have unilaterally decided to raise the minimum wage of their own employees. My attitude generally is, if you're doing the right thing, I don't care why you're doing it. But for purposes of this discussion, I do. Are they doing it for public relations reasons, because it raises morale and productivity? What motivates a major company to spend tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, to increase their employees' wages when they're not required to? And there's no union in this place requiring through collective bargaining.
So let's start with Glenn Nelson, the CEO of The Gap. He announced this as a strategic advancement. He said it's not politics. It's not being driven primarily by some kind of, coursing moral river running through the organization. It's a strategic investment. We need talented, consistent, committed, creative employees, and we believe raising the wage, right? They're going to $9 right away for 65,000 of the company's 90,000 employees in the U.S., $10 in 2015. So it's a big hike, right? We believe this is – we expect this investment to pay for itself many times over. So think about the logic behind that, taking him at the value of his words. You pay people more. there is good evidence that if you pay people more than the minimum wage, productivity goes up more than proportionally, so which is interesting. You pay them more, you're more likely to keep them, you're more likely to attract, you know, talented people. And if you're in a business like Whole Foods or Starbucks or Costco, I mean, you are, you know, your people, your front, what we call your frontline employees, are your ambassadors of the brand, mm-hmm. of the experience, of, you know, of shoppers' loyalty, of what we call positive word of mouth. So every way you measure those kind of metrics, right, this paying employees well, full stop, including benefits in some cases, makes good economic sense. And P.S., there's very good data on this. So this is not something where it sounds like it makes sense. It feels good. So let's buy it on that premise. No, there's lots of good quantitative data about productivity and compensation in companies that tend to, Jim, put a high value on frontline employees. So that piece of it, that last piece of it, has to do in some sense with how you see the experience of the workers in the, on the landscape of the success of your business. Do you think that how workers experience their jobs and are compensated and enjoy respect or promotion possibilities affects your bottom line, or don't you? And the universe of corporate America is divided into two camps, and ne'er the twain shall meet.
And so let's talk now about the, not about the business, but about me or you or Marjorie, the consumer. What's the data on the issue of whether or not people make conscious decisions to patronize? I mean, the Gap, for example, while I still have problems with, I mean, you've read about it, you've probably even written about it. I mean, they're not doing the same kind things to their people doing the manufacturing in Bangladesh that they're doing with their, as you say, their frontline employees.
In the United States.
Putting that aside, and it's pretty hard to put that aside for a minute. If what is the evidence, if any, that consumers patronize or choose to patronize a place that treats its workers better than its competition does?
It's not as extensive as we'd like. It's not as...
The evidence, you're
the
saying.
Evidence is okay, not as extensive as we'd like. And a lot of the evidence is actually, interestingly enough, on the negative side. So we know that there is, and we have quantitative and qualitative data on this, we know that when a scandal breaks, or not even a scandal, just information about what's really going on the value chain in terms of how employees are treated, consumers often will react very negatively, right? There's all kinds of examples of this, including, think about Walmart and all the labor troubles it's had. Mm. One of the reasons Walmart has done so much to deal with its public relations and to deal with its employment practices is because of negative fallout from consumer perception. So we know that on the negative side, it has adverse effects. We know less, partly because it's still, honestly, Jim, an emerging phenomenon in the consuming body politic. We know less about how consumers, you know, with this amazing computer that we all have in our heads, make the choice standing there at the, you know, about where we're going to dinner or where we're going to go buy our kids' clothes or what website we're going to go on based on what they know about the values and practices of the company. We know less about that. My own, you know, educated guess, if you will, about this, or educated prediction, is that this is becoming more and more important to more people. And we know for the millennial cohort, this young group of consumers that will be more and more important as they advance in age and income earning power, for that group of people, it matters a lot.
No, I would suggest, let me just say one last thing about this, Marjorie. I would suggest there's more data than you even may be aware of. When you see those ads, and maybe they're just responding to the negative, when you see the Walmart ads, I'm not a big fan of Walmart. I don't know if I've ever spent a dollar there. When they do these ads celebrating their employees, you almost want to cry. They are as – no, I'm serious. They are as good and persuasive. I have no idea if they're disingenuous or not.
Well, are so those even employees?
Well, yeah, they are. No, you know, well, I don't know if they're actors. Oh, actors, I don't know about that. Yeah, that's a very good point.
I'm suspicious.
But I guess what I want to know is, are they, in your judgment, responding, attempting to rehabilitate themselves from the negative? Oh, so it's less selling the positive for positive sake, but rather trying to really rehabilitate themselves from the negative
it's
PR
like BP,
they've got.
Like all those BP
Yeah, maybe.
Ads
well, that's a very good, that's a wonderful point. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is. And remember that the court of public opinion, right, as it coalesces or crystallizes around a particular company in a particular context is very, very important. It's very important. So, you know, this didn't used to be the case 10, 25 years ago that we thought of marketing, right, and reaching out to consumers as being a battle for the hearts and minds of consumers around the values mm-hmm. and practices of the company. But let me tell you, in an age when we're down on government and we're not sure what kind of agency we have as citizens, we sure as hell want to, you know, we get the hair up on the back of our neck as consumers and we want to act on that, you know, on that ire or on that froth.
You know what I wonder about? I mean, the Gap is a lot of kids go shop there. Banana Republic, I suppose, would be young professionals. Old Navy, you go there if you have lots of kids because you can buy tons of stuff for cheap at Old Navy. But when you go into a more high-end store like a Bloomingdale's or, say, a Neiman Marcus, those are still retail workers that I mean, if they're paid the minimum wage, they sure don't look like it. They look terrific. They're usually older women, mm-hmm. but they have, you know, beautiful outfits on. Their makeup is gorgeous. The people that are selling the makeup and even in the clothes and stuff. So what about those places?
Well, so a lot of those folks are paid on commission, right? And some of those women, I mean, I'm sure you've interviewed some of them on the show over the years.
I haven't.
Right? That would be a very interesting – there are some legendary – right, sales associates at places like Saks, women who bring home six figures, well over six figures, and dress the beautiful people of our city. And there are, you know, there are star salespeople in those kind of contexts. And there are lots of salespeople that make a better living than minimum wage because they're paid on commission. Most beauty, prestige beauty consultants, right, of whatever line
are
paid.
So if Elizabeth Arden,
they're paid by commission.
La
Prairie, so they have a chance to make a decent, a decent living because there's this important upside to it. That's not by no means true of all retail establishments, but the people that you're mentioning in general are paid on commission. That's okay. Why we don't read, you know, about strikes in Bloomingdale's or Neiman Marcus, like, you know, worker unionization efforts in the same way we do in, say, fast food restaurants.
Okay.
So the pay structure is different.
So, Nancy, let's assume you're doing one of the you don't call them trainings. Whatever you do for executives.
Facilitations,
okay. Pardon me.
Coaching.
When you're doing a coaching for executives, and one of the executives raises his or her hand and says, I don't want to hear about your views on social justice. Mm-hmm. I want to hear your views about what's good for business. Mm-hmm. I am thinking about raising the minimum wage for my 72,000 employees. Again, no bleeding heart stuff.
Right,
what's right for people. I want to know what's good. What do you say to them?
I say, you know, look at these companies and why they are doing this. Look at Costco, for example, which is a company that is known to, you know, come down to the penny, you know, the fractions of pennies with suppliers about what the cost of goods is that they buy, that they'll sell in their stores. At the same time, you know, going all the way back to the founder, Sigelman, of the company, there's this philosophy that if we pay people, our associates in the stores, well, we create a good consumer for our products, if you will, but we also create a very, very good disciple of the experience, of the merchandise, of the Costco brand in a land, discount, mass, kind of warehouse merchandising, where there's often not a big premium put on that, so it creates some differentiation. So I tell them to go off and look at the data on companies that make this decision, right, that don't seem to have are not waving a flag of social justice in front of the front door. And there's lots of good evidence on that. Think about Whole Foods. John Mackey hates unions. He's a libertarian.
Hates Obamacare, too.
Right. He's the founder of Whole Foods, and yet his people are by all other retail metrics, well compensated with all kinds of bonus possibilities and access to, you know, what other people, executives in the company are paid, and a whole host of policies that many of us would say sound incredibly progressive and liberal. And yet he says this isn't about liberal or, you know, conservative. It's about running a good business.
Huh. Where does Trader Joe's fit into all this?
They fit into this camp as well.
Okay.
Very much so.
You ever gone to Costco and bought a jar of olives that is larger than you are, Nancy Kane? You really, trust me, apparently you haven't lived until you've bought either a jar of mayonnaise or a jar of olives that is roughly half your size.
227 rolls of paper towels. That's always a problem. Where do you put all that
stuff? You know, we only have 30 seconds. Like, you know what drives me, I don't know if I said this to you or to Marjorie about a week ago, what drives me nuts about this discussion is I am of the camp that don't need convincing. The minimum wage is both a socially just and economically just thing. But then you say, in the words of the great Peggy Lee, is that all there is? So you win the national fight, you get to $10.10 an hour. You win the fight in Massachusetts, you get to $11 an hour. And the person's still making $20,000 a year.
So, all right. So
we
think
have 15
it's,
seconds.
Okay, I think it's ironic that the same day that, you know, Facebook announced a $19 billion acquisition
of WhatsApp,
right, Gap decides to announce the minimum wage. We have a long way to go on building a stable middle class beyond raising the minimum wage.
What should it be, the minimum
Amen.
Wage?
Amen.
$20, $30, $40?
Fifth. Let's start with fifth.
Okay, why not?
Nancy, good to
Nancy
see you.
Nancy Cannon is a historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, great as always to talk to you. And thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy will be with us. We'll also have tips on avoiding Downton Abbey withdrawal with wine expert Jonathan Alsop and food writer Corby Kummer. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And we both want to thank all of you. As we said at the top of the show, it is our one-year anniversary. Thanks for being with us. And we're looking forward to a great second year.
We sure are.
I'm Jim Browdy.
See you later.